Mr. Doherty, Reel 4. You've talked about the cruelties which the Japanese inflicted on you during this period you were by yourself working for them, but did they ever show you any kindnesses ever?
Yes, they did. You see, they had two different sides to the Japanese. As I've told you before, one Jap gave me his cape when it was pouring of rain. And another, when I was dying, his name was a Hagaki, by the way, I don't think I mentioned it. He placed an egg on my chest and put my hand over it and then gave me a bashing so that the other chaps wouldn't see his kind act. But he did a kind act, but he didn't want it to be seen. There was Japanese would try to talk to me as to how my family were in England, how I was. Yet again, they'd turn around and tell me that I'd soon be dead. They were a contrasting nature. No doubt there was good in them, but you see, we live in different upbringings. We're taught different ideals. So a Japanese and an Englishman are two entirely separate races with different ideals. What's good for us would be bad for the Japanese, and what's good for the Japanese would be bad for the English. So therefore, there's a lot of understanding to be done. We look on things as atrocities, but the English and the Australians' atrocities were just as bad. At Lae, New Guinea, they called the Japanese prisoners of war and asked if there were any volunteers to go up on bombing practice. And the Japanese that volunteered were tied hand and foot and put into those bombers at Lae, and that was in August 1945, and to my disgust, they were taken up 3,000 feet up and let go. They were the bombs. These atrocities are things that happen with the Australians as well as with the English, you see.
Did you see this?
I didn't see it happen, but I heard the story of what they'd done, because they bragged to me what they'd done. I wasn't on the spot. I didn't see them get into the plane, but I heard all about it. The other one was when I was in the interpreter coming over the Owen Stanley Ranges from after liberation, when they put these Japanese prisoners in the plane, and one kept saying, "Itai, itai," and the Australian said, "What's he on about?" And he said, "His stomach ached." And he said, "Well, if he doesn't stop itaying, I'll itai him." And he did itai him. He put him out the side doors in one blow, because there are those panic latches on the side of the DC-2s. And he pushed him through there over the Owen Stanleys. There's only one yelp. He didn't say itai anymore, I agreed, but it was rather, it's what these things that happen that stick in your mind, you know. The Australian soldiers came there into Lae, New Guinea afterwards, asking me what the Japs had said and what they'd who'd been the cruelest, and really striving to get to know the names of these people, to get at them and said, "We'll pay them back for me." I said, "Oh, Christ," you know, I was in bed then in the hospital. But it was, see, we're also to blame for lots of things. They go and condemn these men on the words of prisoners of war, that's just out of privation. And at that time, the soldiers' dire need to impress people, etc., tell a lot of things that they possibly wouldn't if they thought about it for a little while, and was there any reason behind it. So therefore, these Japanese, some of them, had vengeance put upon them, which maybe they didn't earn. Some of them did earn it. I mean, Mackie, he nearly knocked me into the ground with the sticks and
who was he,
stones,
a Japanese?
But, I mean, he did this, but there's others that I suppose it was more family men. I suppose it was from what portion of the community they come from and how is they built up a position, their reaction to how they behaved, you see. I mean, you can get a labourer and put him in some circumstance, same as those soldiers I was telling you about. Some of those soldiers knocked the Japanese down, knocked the Chinese down to grab the bread from them. In my eyes, that was wrong. But in their eyes, that's the way they've been brought up. So we're two different nations, which a lot of people condemn the Japanese. You get 99% of Japanese prisoners of war, and they say, well, they shoot the first Japanese they see, and all this sort of business. But I think it's time for human beings really to understand that people have different views. They've got different ideas, therefore they act differently. It'd be a terrible world if we all acted the same, after all. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
Very much so. But you said something earlier about when you were dying.
Yes.
When was that?
Well, that was when I was... As I say, with the Japanese there, I was dying of malaria. And, of course, I wouldn't get no food when I wasn't working.
Was this on Watum?
Yeah, on Watum. And I wouldn't get any food if I was working, so it didn't make much difference. But the time you need food and you're ill, you can't forage around, you can't get anything for yourself. So, therefore, you're getting weaker and weaker. And I was left there to die, and Mackie just threw a billhook into the roof of this little shed and said if I wanted to finish myself off, there was the billhook, I could do it, you see.
Or to hang yourself?
No, to kill myself, to put the billhook into my chest, however you like, cut my throat with it, do what I like with it, if I could reach it. But at that time, I had no thought of suicide whatsoever. I thought that somehow I'd be released. I realised the possibilities was very, very scarce, very, very chancy, but somehow I'd get out of it. Don't know how, but then other times I thought, well, it's impossible, because if the English invade or the Allies invade, the first ones to die would be us.
You said also earlier that there was a lack of food for the Japanese. Were they suffering from lack of food?
Well, you see, the Japanese Air Force had been... Yes, the Japanese Air Force had been destroyed, so the Japanese had to make their own gardens and grow what little they could for themselves. And everywhere they went on the islands, they'd take cuttings of potato leaves and dig them into put them into the soil wherever they went. So all over the jungle, in a few years' time, I dare say by now even, the sweet potato has taken over and it's all over the island. But that was their way of, as they were thinking they were going to be on the island for centuries and centuries and centuries, because they'd never give in. But it turned out different, as we now know. But in those days, we didn't know how it was going to finish. We knew the Japanese wouldn't give in. And we knew if the Allies had invaded, we'd be killed. So we didn't have much hope of getting out alive. I used to think that somehow we would, which turned out right in the end, but I couldn't foresee how. I didn't know anything about the atomic bomb then. Well, I knew about the atomic bomb, because I'd read it in comics before the war. But never thought it would happen. Still, that's another story, isn't it? Shall we keep on this one?
Yes, there was something earlier you said which you didn't come back to, which you'd intended to, and that was about the Sikhs, when they put their hands up.
Well, I was very ashamed afterwards to find out that the Sikhs had volunteered to act as warders over the sections of the prisoners. And for that they were going to get preferential treatment, and they were to be a part of the southeastern... what do you call it? Collaboration. And to my disgust, they was warders over our place, our boys, for some time, till they got taken themselves, and then they was also made to work on the railways later on, you see.
So there were waters of you in Changi?
Not in Changi, I didn't see any. I've never seen a Sikh guard on sentry against me. But all I can say is that other prisoners of war told me there were. But I never saw them myself, so I couldn't vouch for that. I may have been told a pack of lies. I hope I have, because I like the Sikhs, but when they did that, it filled me with disgust that soldiers like that could do such a thing. But there. I did see the, it might be a point of interest, I think I'm about one of the only white men alive that saw the start of the Bismarck Sea Battle and the Coral Sea Battle when they left Rabaul.
Could you tell me about that?
Yes. They had all types of ships, from little tiny coal coasters, which were loaded with Japanese soldiers, horses, guns, all superstructured out with 2x2 to make room for them to get on. And they left by two convoys. One convoy went out of Rabaul Harbour and headed southwest. The other one went out around Matabar Volcano, and that went east. That was going around the head of New Britain. The ones that went south were the ones for the Coral Sea Battle. The ones that went east were the ones for the Bismarck Sea Battle. From what I heard after the war, and that's not quite right though, because it's not my no, but what I understand is that the ones that went to the Coral Sea Battle were to land at Townsville, and the ones that went round the top of New Guinea were coming down to land on Cape York to take off that peninsula, which would be a foothold for the Japanese invading forces. At the same time, another one was due to leave from Timor to go across to Darwin. That would be the invasion of Australia. I think there must have been at least 500,000 Japanese soldiers killed in those two raids.
What was their morale as they went off?
They were full of what they were going to do. They were full of how they were going to take Australia. They were full of how they're going to give the Australians a good time.
What do they mean by a good time?
Well, how they're going to build Australia up. It's their empire they're going to build. They took New Ireland. New Ireland was just across. They're going to send some boats from ships from there. The ships were just a mass of ships, one glorified mass of cargo ships, a few warships amongst them, and they were just absolutely crammed full of Japanese soldiers. So the slaughter must have been terrific. I have never read how many were actually killed in that battle, but I would put it at close on 500,000. It must have been a terrific amount.
You said earlier that some of the POWs you were with on New Britain went insane. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I can. You see, Marshall. Marshall was the sub-editor of the Times. They went funny in their head. Lieutenant Gribble was laying down and looking up through the tent and saying he saw Haytham or somebody whoever Haytan was, I don't know, he saw a Haytan up there and all daft sort of things he was talking. And then in the end he decided not to eat at all, to refuse everything that came to him, and he willed himself to die. There's another bloke, Pike, his name was, I think it was Pike, yeah. He decided in front of everybody to drive a needle he'd got, a hook needle, and dive it right into his heart, in front of everybody.
How did he get hold of that needle?
I don't know. But he had the needle, and he did it. The other bloke I told you about, who got all those potatoes, boiled them up and ate a lot, and killed himself. The other bloke that got the quinine, instead of sharing amongst his mates, had them all himself. Oh dear. You asked me for examples all that time ago, and I can't even remember the names now. What is it? Ooh, must be 40 years ago now. Must be, yes. Anyway, we were daft, absolutely silly. We would fight over on Christmas Day one year. The German people that were on the island from somewhere or another got a horse's head into us, and we boiled it up. The only way we could divide it was by putting it all into a soup. And their fights broke out there because one bloke got a bit of bone and another bloke didn't. It was silly things, but they happened. Don't suppose of importance, but just things that you come out with, you know.
Did you have much contact with the German community there?
No, we weren't allowed to speak to anybody like that. And as I say, in the latter years when I was on Batum, I couldn't even speak to a white man. A bloke named Fowler got through to me once, came onto the edge of the encampment where I was, and he got over to my side of the island. Well, when I saw him, I said, "Hello, Joe Fowler," you see. Because I said, that pleased to see somebody. And the chaps came in there, and Fowler was beaten up and taken back to his own camp. Don't know where it was, but somewhere. Taken back to his own camp, and I understand he was beaten up terribly because of his trying to speak to me. I wasn't allowed to speak with anybody except Japanese soldiers. That was in reality, but I spoke to Kanakas.
What surprises me about your period of isolation is why they picked on you to isolate you.
Well, that I don't really know. They decided that. I think it must have been an experiment. They put me in a pig pen, and they threw sweet potato leaves into me the same as the pigs were being fed on. Of course you couldn't eat them.
Were you actually in with the pigs?
Yeah, no, the next tie to it. Next tie. But I think it was their sense of humour. I think it was their sense of humour mostly, but they soon put me to work.
And how long were you in the pigsty?
Well, only about 3 or 4 days, I think.
And then where did you live?
I built my hut. I had to build my grass hut, you see. It was bamboo poles. And I went out and got the grass, the long grass, to put on the roofs to form a bit of shelter. It was only a small thing, about, I suppose, 10 by 8. It was just enough to get under out of the rain. And if it did rain, I'd love to go out there and have a wash, so it would seem stupid. But anyway, because I used to, if it rained, it was beautiful because you could have a good wash. Because when it rains, it really does rain, I can tell you, it buckets down. But that was my little hut, and I built that. And that's where I lived until the white ants devoured it themselves.
And then what did you do?
I had to build another one. I think I built three in all. But
what kind of clothes did you have by now?
Just a hondoshi. A hondoshi is what I've explained already.
And did that last you the whole time? Or did they have to renew it?
No, it just lasted me the whole time. As a matter of fact, I've still got it. I'll keep that. I don't know why I keep it, but I'll keep it.
You mentioned earlier a Kanaka ceremony of the new moon. Can you tell me what that was?
Oh, yeah, but if it's any interest. It's a blood-curdling thing, really. You see, you've got to imagine mountains all round you and jungle, and it's dead quiet. And then suddenly a voice comes out from one of the mountains, something like, it's dead silence, you see, all round. And then the big drums start up, and it comes up, boom da boom 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 da boom boom boom. And then the next mountain takes it up, because they've seen the new moon, and it goes all the way round, and this carries on with this big drum going after each one. And then as it gets to the last mountain, everyone, all the Kanakas on the island, all come in with that tune. And when it finishes, there's just this dong as they're singing out, that last note. I'm no singer, so I might do it. If I was Petulia Clark, I might give you a better recitation of it. But nevertheless, it's at that moment, the whole jungle becomes, well, the whole earth, not the jungle, the whole earth goes silent. Not even the ants whisper. Nothing goes on. It's pitch black. And it goes dead quiet then. And the hairs on the back of your neck seems to start curling. and it's all quiet again, and you go to sleep. So that's more or less the answer of the festival.
Of the new moon.
Mm.
I think there was one occasion when you attempted an escape. Could you tell me about that?
Yeah, I'll tell you about it. Well, if it didn't come off, I deducted that if I made this raft, I could get it into the sea, and by pushing the thing, I could get about a mile or two out before the sun rose, if I took it at night time. So I collected these coconuts, because I'd want food and I'd want water. So I collected the coconuts, and I made this raft and got right near to the beach as I could. It's a big hedge across there to hide me, so I made it there. And after many months, I got this thing ready with all the coconuts on, and I thought with a bit of exertion, I could get this heavy raft to the sea and float it and away. Well, that sounded all right, and it seemed okay. I had a 50-50 chance of being shot up if I got out into the sea, but I was going to take my chance. So I came down this night in question when it was all ready. I got down the mountainside without being seen, right to the beach, and then I dragged this raft the extra 10 yards up to this hedge bit, went to cut my way through the hedge, and found it was barbed wire covered with foliage. On the other side, I'd waited for the Japs to go their different ways first, so as I got a clear run to the beach. But then I found it was impossible for me to get it through this barbed wire, which had a pit on the other side. A large ditch, which I hadn't thought about. I realised I'd have to give it up. But if I didn't hurry, the moon would have risen over the top of the mountains and shone down on the beach underneath, where it had become daylight with the moon. So I had to leave everything where it was and dash. And it seemed like racing the shadow of the mountains to get back there without being seen. Well, somehow or other, I don't know how, but I got back to my place, my little hut, and I flopped down. But it didn't come off. If it had come off, I don't think I would have got away. I don't think I'd have stood an earthly chance. But in these cases, something makes you say, well, I'll have a go. And you work it all out, and it seems so feasible at that time. When you look back at it, it seems so ridiculous. But at least I tried.
Did you ever have any contact with POWs of any different nationality from the British?
Well, there was these... I was in the cookhouse at Changi for a little while. None of us knew how to cook rice. I mean, we had a big bath there. We chucked in the rice and chucked in the boiling water, and what came out was supposed to be rice. Well, it's a horrible, sloppy mess. Anyway, there's a big contingent of fellas come in, and they all spoke a bit funny. Until I pulling one bloke's bowl up, big bloke in front of me, and I says, "Here." I says, "You load of Yanks." And he grabbed me by the shirt to the front and pulled me right up to his nose. He says, "Listen here, sonny, I ain't no Yank, I'm a Texan." He dropped me flat like that. That's the last I had to do with American. I never had occasion to drop into any others, except that one in the plane that turned around and opened up on me. I think I told you about that.
What were relations like between British and Dutch POWs?
Well, I only saw them in their green uniforms. I mean, I didn't have occasion to talk to any. But other prisoners of war looked at them with disgust, but I think it was just prejudice of language, because we didn't understand what they were talking about. No, I suppose they were decent blokes in their own ways. But the British bloke would run down anything if it was in his way. I don't know. No, I haven't got anything to say against them. I can't really give an opinion about them. They seem decent blokes to me, just by pure observation from a distance. But I didn't speak their language and had no reason to contact them. Kanakas, they come in the category? Kanakas were very nice. They're very simple, pleasant people. Although they were cannibals, they were very nice people. Very, very friendly. They'd do anything if they could help me, but they was in great danger, of course, because if they could have been caught helping me, they'd have been executed in some way.
You mentioned earlier the American air raids. Were any of the Americans shot down?
Quite a few. I suppose I better tell you. One poor fella, he ended up with the Japs there, and they wanted to know something from him. God knows what it was. The American couldn't speak Japanese, and the Japanese couldn't speak English. And there's about six of the blokes here, and they got one of these 45-gallon drums, and they just stuck it under a fire with boiling water in it, filled it up, and then they split this coconut open and scored the inside out and made a cup out of it, made a ladle out of the whole thing, and then they started pouring water over this American, boiling water. And he says the American was screaming, and the Japs kept on asking him. I didn't speak any Japanese at that time. The Japs kept on asking him to speak, and the Jap says, "I don't know goddamn nothing." And so he was screaming incoherently, and all his skin was turning pink and red, like the red dots in the centre. You know how you get this when you're cold? And the spots start getting blue, don't they, when you get cold, and the veins on the outside go pink. Well, it was the other way round. It was scarlet and pink, the colours all over him, and he was moving and screaming, but the bloke was dead, and yet he was screaming and he was moving. I says, and this something I never forget, I never will forget that, because I hear his screams at night time now. I couldn't make myself seen. I was in the jungle. I couldn't say anything or do anything. I felt hopeless. Yet this bloke died in front of my eyes.
Was this
on
must have
been a death. This was just outside Coca-Cola. What they got out of that, I don't know, because neither of them learned anything. The bloke lost his life in the depths.